stay locked in and fully loaded.
Ashanti Radio
and Verkay Radio.
They said we couldn't do it,
but we global now, worldwide. Boom, in your face. Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, Staten, and Manhattan. You are listening to BashaniRadio.com. New York City, always talking about everything.
You know how sometimes things line up? Coincidences? Since we've been up here, they've been happening more and more. It's like there's this black cloud hanging over us.
There's a family in our driveway.
Who is that?
Run.
Insurance companies overcharge you? Do you believe that you pay enough monthly and you should not have to pay a deductible when the coverage is needed? Unfortunately, deductibles are real, and we at We Pay All Your Deductibles offer you a warranty for about 1.5% monthly of the cost of your deductible to pay your deductible when you need it. We give back 25% back every 2 years if the time never arises. Sign up for our warranty and you will have one up on the high cost of insurance on your cars, homes, motorcycles, cell phones, and boats. We pay all your deductibles.
Millionaire Mentorship. Millionaire Mentorship. The Millionaire Mentorship Show with Dr. Herbert Harris on Bashani Radio and iHeart Radio.
You are now tuned in to the Millionaire Mentorship Show with Dr. Herbert Harris on Bashani Radio, always talking about everything from New York City. We are available on iTunes, iHeart Radio, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, and anywhere a mobile device is available.
Ooh, yeah. I got the power. The power's in my hands. And you only wish that you could understand. I got the power. The power's in my hands. And you only wish that you could understand.
This is Dr. Herbert Harris, author of the 12 Universal Laws of Success. I am your transformational speaker and trainer. We've written 8 books, had our books translated into many languages, but we are now engaged in transforming the lives of 10 million people, helping them to be what they want to be, do what they want to do, and have whatever they want to have. The concept of the Millionaire Mentorship Show is that wealth, success, and all things come to us based on consciousness. The spiritual principle is, seek first the kingdom, and all these things will be added unto you. Kingdom is consciousness, awareness. The purpose of the Millionaire Mentorship Show is to help you develop the awareness and consciousness of wealth, health, success, prosperity, and money, and to attract these things into your life. So, if you want to attract health, wealth, happiness, love, success, prosperity, and money into your life, you are in the right place. I would also like to thank our listeners for making the Millionaire Mentorship Show the number one program on the Bashani Radio Network with over 2 million listeners. With listeners like you, nothing is impossible. So keep up the good works, folks. If we keep on listening, sharing, and subscribing, and we'll rise together to greater heights. Send your questions and comments to Herbert@HerbertHarris.com, and I'd love to share some of them on the air. Everyone who sends in a comment or a question will receive a free audio download of The 4 Principles of Wealth Building. You can also schedule a free Millionaire Mentorship consultation where I will help you do you. This is Dr. Herbert Harris. If you would like more information about how you may become a millionaire, text the word millionaire, that's M-I-L-L-I-O-N-A-I-R-E, to 58885. That's 5-888-5 to get more information and a special gift. Our guest today is Dr. Philip Clay, former chancellor of MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And in fact, Dr. Clay is the highest ranking black administrator in the 150-year history of MIT. He's also a professor of housing policy and city planning. And he has been a member of the MIT faculty since 1995 and held various leadership positions at the university, with the culmination being his appointment as chancellor in 2001, a position that he held through 2010. Philip Clay is widely known for his work in U.S. housing policy and community-based development. His work on the erosion of low-income rental housing documented the need for a national preservation policy. He has served on the national commission that developed and recommended the policy part of the Housing Act of 1990. Dr. Clay has served on numerous prestigious boards, including the National Housing Trust, Community Builders, the nation's largest nonprofit developer of affordable housing, the MasterCard Foundation, the Kresge Foundation, and the Board of Trustees of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Dr. Clay is a native of my hometown, Wilmington, North Carolina, received his AB degree from UNC at Chapel Hill, and his doctorate in city planning from MIT. So my friend and hometown hero, Dr. Philip Clay, welcome to the Millionaire Mentorship Show.
Thank you very much, Herb, but I appreciate it, and I look forward to chatting with you and your audience.
Well, thank you. I'm just super grateful that you agreed to do the show. And one of the reasons I wanted you to do our show was to really give insight, you know, on really one of the key challenges of our times, the disappearance of affordable housing and its impact on all communities, especially the black community. But before going into that, I just want to focus on the fact that you are the first and only African-American chancellor of MIT. And that must have been a very interesting process. You know, every time I think about that, maybe you could share a little insight about how that all came about.
Well, first of all, let me correct you. I joined the MIT faculty in 1975, not 1995. So I'm older than your audience.
Might have been led to believe. Yes.
But I'm grateful for every year. I think that, you know, the appointment as chancellor in 2001, I'm not sure that there was a process. The person who had been in the position before left to take another position, and I got a call from the president asking if I would be willing to be considered. I took the weekend to talk it over with my wife and took it. I think it's important, if there's any part of your question that I think would be interesting to your audience, it's not so much about how it happened, because that's a mystery, which I can get into later. But I think what's clear about my life is that I have a service gene that's expressed. That if people ask me to do things, I tend not always to accept, but certainly to consider. And this was an honor, and it was a promotion, and it was an opportunity for me to continue to serve. I had, at the time I was appointed, I had been associate provost. So it wasn't as though I was new to administration. I had been department head before that. So it was a process of sort of serving and not screwing up and then being in line for consideration for the next possibility.
Beautiful. And I like that you say, to be in line. I think that many times, you know, I work a lot with young business people and educational people, and sometimes people sort of forget that idea that there is a line, and you kind of have to wait your turn. You have to be prepared for the next level, but it may not come exactly when you want it to come.
And it may not come in the place you want it to come. I've been associated with lots of organizations, so I see the process for identifying and developing and engaging talent. And you should know that your audience members should know that there's always a search for the next talented person, not necessarily to head an organization, but to get in line. I mean, you know, I was head of the main committee in the department. Then I became department head. The provost is the senior officer. I became associate provost and then chancellor. And none of those positions did I apply. But the culture of the organization was that they tended to prefer to take leaders from the inside. Mm. Now, it doesn't happen 100% of the time, but for the most part, leaders are promoted from within. So there is an invisible line. Sometimes you get a hint that a line exists. But also in academia, if somebody is campaigning for a job, you probably don't want them. Mm. So it's a matter of doing your work, trying to do your job the best you can. And then you know that people are looking at you. And if you have an opportunity, you get it, you use it, you take it. If you don't screw up, they'll probably keep looking at you for the next opportunity.
Mm. And so preparation is key. And yes. to always do your best. Preparation and performance. You know, I interviewed George Frazier, you know, with the Power Networking and a lot of the work he's done with the Black Business Networking. And one of the key things George said was excellence. To whatever the task is, to always do your best, because he said someone is always watching, and he said it's a good thing. Someone's always saying, now that guy does a good job, he's dedicated, and if there ever comes a time that I need a good person, he's the one.
Yeah, there's people always looking for talent. Mm. People always looking for friends. They're always looking for, you know, the best plumber or the best place to get your car fixed. Mm. And that happens all throughout society.
Well, you know, Doc, I was preparing for the interview today, and, you know, it's very interesting. I actually found a letter of mine that I wrote in, I won't even give you the year, but it was like before 1960, where I had actually considered going to MIT. I'd written a letter, and I think I was in the correspondence stage and whatnot. But one of the things, MIT seems to have a unique connection to Wilmington. Really the first Black graduate from MIT was Robert R. Taylor, who entered MIT in 1888, was also from Wilmington, North Carolina.
Yeah, his father was a contractor. He was interested in architecture and came to MIT, did very well, and went on to be both an architect and an educator. An architect, I think he headed the architecture program at Tuskegee, designed most of the buildings on that campus. And then I think he came back to Wilmington to retire. I think he died in the early 40s.
Yes, he did. And the interesting thing, I owned the house two doors down from where he lived. He lived on McCray Street. I owned 305, and I think he was at 311 McCray Street. So you know, and the house is still there, the sign, they finally put a plaque up. But, you know, it was ironic that he was the first black graduate. He started in 1888, and 113 years later, you're the first black chancellor. So whatever we're doing here in Wilmington, we need to keep it up.
Well, we have honored him at MIT. There's a fellowship and a professorship named in his honor, and he's prominent in our records.
Well, you know, it seems that MIT was very instrumental. Booker T. Washington visited on numerous occasions, and they actually seem to use a lot of the MIT structure and concept in putting Tuskegee Institute together. So hats off to MIT for that kind of insight.
Thanks.
Now, you know, so often today in working with young people, in your growth, did you find that race was an impediment, your race was? And if so, how did you handle it?
Well, I'm sure race was an impediment. Sometimes it expressed itself. Other times I just knew it existed, but I didn't quite know how it worked. And that's still a mystery sometimes. I don't quite know why somebody treated me the way they did and whether the difference was racial or had some other explanation. But the way I handled it was always to take the view that, well, first of all, I think education was presented to me and to you too, because I think you were about 3 years ahead of me at Williston.
Yes.
As is very important. And that, in fact, I remember somebody saying to me when I was young, you know, still in school, high school, that, you know, the man can take your land, they can take your money, but they can't take anything out of your head. And if you get an education, you use it well, you conduct yourself in a manner that befits your abilities and your calling, that can't be taken away from you. Now, you can be slow to be promoted and you can perhaps not get the job that you like, but you won't live a life of destitution. You also will have an opportunity, because even in the segregated world, there was a search for talented black people, often within employed within a narrow range of things. And happily, in my life and your lifetime, those opportunities opened up dramatically. So, yeah, I'm sure I was prevented from certain things, but I did well anyway. Mm-hmm. And just to give you one example, when I went to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the main scholarship offered to talented men, because they didn't accept women at the time, was the Moorhead Scholarship. And there was a time when they didn't give opportunities to blacks to be Moorhead scholars. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of one situation. I wasn't able to compete for a main scholarship. The other thing was, I learned this because I remember as a sophomore, I went to apply for financial aid, and I applied. And one of the things I learned was that they calculated the expected grade point average of students who admitted, and it was on that basis that they gave scholarships. Scholarships at that time were not based on need, but on quote-unquote merit.
Mm.
So the score they calculated for me was a couple of tenths of a point below their cutoff for merit. Now, when I found that out, I was a bit, of course, hurt and surprised, because I didn't think I had a problem. I had made the dean's list the first semester I was there, and the dean's list cutoff was significantly higher than the cutoff for getting a merit scholarship. So I took that not so much as discrimination, because what they probably based it on was, well, you didn't come from one of the better high schools. You came from a colored school down east somewhere. Therefore, you're not going to do as well as, you know, the white guys who, you know, are typically our best performers. So I took it not as something that caused me to shy away or feel discouraged. I took it as a challenge. And I did fine at UNC and then went on to get a PhD. And I have a number of friends who had similar experiences. And, you know, in that situation, you don't get mad, you get even.
Mm. That's a powerful thought, because so often people get discouraged and throw in the towel when they could just figure out a way, as you said, look at it as a challenge and make you, I guess, rise above what you normally would do, to do a little better than your best.
And certainly better than they expect me, because their expectations are low, or low based on race. They hadn't met me. They didn't know anything about me other than some numbers from the application and the record.
Well, that my next question was, you know, did you ever get really, really discouraged? Did there ever come a time when it seemed like you may want to quit or throw in the towel?
No. There was never a time like that, especially having anything to do with work or education.
Mm.
There was a time where I sort of had to give up. I was drafted about 2 weeks after I graduated from college. And this was during the time of the Vietnam War. And I wasn't in favor of the war, and I wasn't interested in serving, and I didn't want to be in the military. So I proceeded to learn about selective service law. And there were 13 different ways out of being drafted. And over the course of the next 14 months, I went through all 13 of those. I would apply for something, wait 2 weeks, they would reject it, then I would apply for something else, and so forth and so on, until I made it through. And I was able to get 1 year of graduate work in before having to face the choice. Either when they sent the draft notice, I would go, or I would, you know, do something else, like, you know, go to Canada, or, you know, cut off a trigger finger, something like that. So I didn't do any of those things. I also didn't, you know, declare that I was a minister or marry somebody and adopt a child real fast to get out of it that way. I just said, I'll persevere in this and come out fine on the other end. And thankfully, that is how it happened.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, Doc, I tell you, that's a great place to end right now. We're going to take a pause for the cause. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about some of these critical issues with affordable housing. So let me just take a break, and we'll be right back. You are now tuned in to the Millionaire Mentorship Show with Dr. Herbert Harris on Bishani Radio, always talking about everything from New York City. We are available on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, and anywhere a mobile device is available. All right, folks, it's Dr. Herbert Harris, and we're continuing with our interview of Dr. Philip Clay, former chancellor of MIT. Dr. Clay, you know, when I was looking at your research on affordable housing, it seems that it's disappearing. So what is, like, you might say, the state right now of affordable housing, maybe on a national scale?
Well, on a national scale, it's a serious problem, and the problem looks differently depending on where you are. But I don't know of any part of the country where housing is not a very complex and daunting area for investment as well as consumption. And let me sort of give you three different versions of the problem. Mm-hmm. The version of the problem here in Boston is that after about 40 years of population decline, the city's population has started to increase. Lots of young people taking jobs in medicine, education, science, technology, and neighborhoods that had been overlooked for all of those years are now very popular. And as a result, the housing values, prices, and rents are all going up sharply. Now, for those of us who got into it early, I bought my first house in 1975 for $35,000. Now, I don't live in that house anymore. I've, like many other people, moved up, traded, moved to a different neighborhood, actually different part of the same neighborhood. But that house now is worth 20 times what I paid for it in 1975. That's what I could afford in 75. But I can assure you that a young person starting out as an assistant professor now could not afford to buy that house. It's also true that the people who live down the street who rented affordable apartments, those apartments now are no longer affordable, and many of them have been converted to condos that sell nearly as much, sometimes more, than the houses nearby. So that's the Boston version. The North Carolina version, and of course, I understand that different parts of the state and different parts of the states are doing differently. But the part there is that incomes have not gone up as much in North Carolina as the value of housing. So the people who are able to squeeze into a starter house in the past now find that those starter houses don't exist. And their incomes are too low to squeeze into those houses, even if they did exist. And prices are going up because land is more expensive, buildings more expensive. All of the things that go into housing are now more expensive. We don't have a national strategy, and most places don't have a local strategy for making affordable housing part of the development boom. And we are experiencing a boom here, and I suspect you're growing, and housing is being built in North Carolina, but it's not being built for people at the bottom end of the market. It's also increasingly not being built for young college graduates because a terrible fraction, terribly high fraction of those young people are burdened by college debt. There's now more debt held by young college graduates than by all of us in terms of credit cards, $1.5 trillion. And that's a huge drag on housing consumption. And it's a drag on the ability of young people to do a variety of things. And of course, they have to make choices. And one of the choices they're not making is to try to squeeze into housing, which is, as I indicated, very expensive. So that's a couple of versions of the problem, and it's a serious one.
Mm. Yeah, I noticed here in Wilmington, that exact same thing. And I still have our family homestead on Worcester Street. And the prices have gone up just in the last 5 years, have virtually doubled in this area. And so the old people have died out. The renters now can't really afford it anymore. I see the type of renter changing. And I'm sure that over the next 5 years, thank goodness our house is paid for. So we can hang in there. So.
Yeah.
Is there a solution, that let's just say on a local level, is there something that people can do on a local level that might either stem the tide or give poor people a better chance, a better seat at the table?
Well, there's several different options that can be implemented at the local level. Of course, you have to have a political regime that's open to doing this. And North Carolina is relatively conservative. But just to give you an illustration of some things that can be done, in Boston, where I described the problem, the city forces developers to include a certain fraction of affordable units in developments that are built, private, luxury, middle income. And the last I heard, about 20% of the units built are affordable. Now, affordable differs depending on how it's defined, but usually they mean working class families.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one approach. Another approach is to tax the sale of real estate transfers. That was first done in Florida, and we have it in parts of Massachusetts as well. So if you were to buy a house or sell a house, there would be a small tax added to it if the house were above a certain threshold. And that money raised goes into a fund to subsidize housing. Another approach is a state housing finance agency. We've had one in Massachusetts for at least 50 years. And basically, they go out and borrow money on the bond market, which means it's relatively inexpensive compared to a mortgage. That money is then loaned to developers or to individuals for home purchase. And that works reasonably well as long as, you know, a house is properly developed and well situated to be sustainable. So those are just three ways of helping.
Yeah, that's interesting, Doc, because, you know, just a coordinated approach based on the area in which you're operating. And that political piece is extremely important, even as a foundation for all the others. You got to have somebody at the table who can advocate on your behalf, whether it's, you know, through real estate taxing or a state housing agency. It all comes back to politics, doesn't it?
Absolutely. No way around it.
Well, Doc, I tell you, our time is just about up, and you know, I feel like we just started. Is there any, I guess, two-form? One, any thoughts to give to parents? I think so many parents now are facing that dilemma of education for their kids, and I think one of the new things I see now is when the kids get the student loans, they're asking parents to co-sign. Okay. And so is there any advice you can give the parents who really would like to see the best for their children? Anything that frame of reference, any financial, but anything that a parent can do to help their give their children, you might say, at least a decent start in the academic area?
Well, this could be a separate discussion and could go on for a long time, but I give one piece of advice, which I think is critically important. There are a lot of educational opportunities out there that are ripoffs, and they're not inexpensive. Some of them are very expensive, and many young people will drift to those things because of the advertising associated with them. So I think this thing, and of course, most students today don't have a Mrs. Grady that you and I had, who provided counseling and helped students make not just good decisions and advise parents, but also to go out and beat the bushes for financial aid and for advice on how to get into the best school. So what I would suggest for parents is that they try to get the best information available to their young people so that they make a wise decision in the first place. About 20% of our young Black college-bound students go to for-profit colleges. And I don't want to say that all of them are terrible, but most of them are. And I think as a general rule, they should be avoided. And if they are approached, they should be approached because the parents and the young person conclude that they're legitimate and honest and provide an education, not just a piece of paper. And by the way, most students don't graduate from these schools, which means the money is lost.
Wow. Doc, that is a pearl, because you see so many advertisements for these different schools. And as you say, the moment you put the profit motive into it, it changes the dynamics of everything, whether it's education, whether it's prisons, whether it's running agencies. The moment you put profit into it, it can change the score. Wow.
Okay, well, thanks very much. I enjoyed being on your show, and I'm happy to do it again sometime.
Thank you so much, Dr. Philip Clay, my friend, former Wilmingtonian, and the first and only Black Chancellor of MIT. Have a great day. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I got the power. The power is in.
This is Dr. Herbert Harris. If you would like more information about how you may become a millionaire, text the word millionaire, that's M-I-L-L-I-O-N-A-I-R-E, to 58885. That's 5-888-5 to get more information and a special gift. You are now tuned into the Millionaire Mentorship Show with Dr. Herbert Harris on the Shiny Radio, always talking about everything from New York City. We are available on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, and anywhere a mobile device is available. See you next week, folks, and tune in at any time to hear the Millionaire Mentorship Show with thoughts that can change your life.
Millionaire Mentorship. Millionaire Mentorship. The Millionaire Mentorship Show with Dr. Herbert Harris on Vashani Radio and iHeart Radio.
Hours a day, 7 days a week, on demand, powerful talk radio. We global, and you can do nothing about it. BashaniRadio.com. Always talking about everything. Keep it locked.